only knew the tales about your kind. It took me some time to realize that tales sometimes are just tales. But without the Minionship Pact ensuring that we couldn't trick each other, I don't think I would have ever trusted you.
Fair enough, Ed said. From what I understand, mistrusting a dungeon lord is probably the smart thing to do. But I disagree about you not trusting me without the pact. With enough time, we would have realized we are on the same side. I believe that to be true to the very core of my being, Kes. Perhaps Alvedro will come to realize it as well. Kes shook her head and grinned mirthlessly.
Ah, bother. See what I told you? I suck at talking about my feelings. I've misled you without meaning to. I'm over Al, Ed. I've been through breakups before. I'm not a hatchling anymore. When it's over, it's over. And life's pile of dung is always growing, whether you're done digging out of the most recent landslide or not. So you may as well enjoy it while you have fresh air. And hell, there are things you can't take back after you say them, even if you don't mean them. And Al crossed a line back there. If the gods somehow become merciful, perhaps in the future she and I may come to amicable terms. But that's pretty much it. She's not what I'm concerned about.
Oh. Ed blinked. What could he say to that? I'm sorry. That would have to do.
When we made our pact, I thought I was going to die,
Kes repeated, this time giving an edge of intensity to her words. She bent forward on her chair.
Don't you see? In a way, that's what I wanted, Ed.
She frowned, her gaze lost in some distant memory.
All my life I wanted to end injustice, to stop people from suffering. When I was a hatchling, I'd see the bigger kids picking on the smaller ones and my blood would just boil. I got into so many fights, the eldest, that I simply loved violence. And maybe I do. Who knows? Maybe justice is just a lie I tell myself so I can stab as many people as I want. But if it is, I sure wish it at least felt better.
She rested her eyes on her sheathed sword, studying it intently, as if looking for some deep truth inside.
My urge to fight never went away as I aged, so I joined the Cardinal Command. I believed it was the right thing to do. I was stronger and bigger than most avians, and there was a war going on, so I volunteered. I still remember what I told my mother when she heard the news. I'd fight so others wouldn't have to, and I'd be the best at it, damn it. So the Minotaurs would have to think twice about coming after our people. I arrived at the Cardinal Command's boot camp and I found myself surrounded by people just like me. Scared, nervous, excited. Green. And then Rhea and the others forged us into finely tuned weapons. Together, we were invincible. We would uphold justice with our wings and our spears. Then the fighting began and all that plummeted straight into the ground.
Ed's throat knotted up all of a sudden.
Avian's only advantage against a Minotaur are our wings. They are bigger and stronger than us, and they can saddle their bodies with energy-demanding talents because of their insane endurance. No matter how well trained, or how many hundreds of experience points you have, if you fight a Minotaur head-on, you'll die. So, we fight them in waves, from afar. Our army tries to break their ranks by raining projectiles and area of effect spells on them, and they hold on with defensive magic, nets, and ballistas. Most battles, neither army breaks, and we go back to camp and repeat it all the next day. But if, say, the Minotaur flank fails at blocking a volley of spells and they lose cohesion, then our squads dive in,
she demonstrated by plunging her hand down through an imaginary air current and then lifting back up right at the last moment.
We use enchanted spears we call steel talons, long-weighted shafts with barbed tips. and fly almost straight down at max speed. The Minotaur archers try to guess our flight pattern and shoot us, and sometimes they get lucky. An arrow from a bow strong enough to resist the pull of a Bronn 25 arm can turn half a dozen avians into mincemeat before anyone realizes what just happened. If the arrows don't kill you and you aimed your path well, there's this instant where you have a Minotaur right below you and you have all the momentum of your plunge. So you spear them with your steel talon right as you pull back up. Mind you, this only works because we enchant our wings. Otherwise, we'd just splat on the ground. If you don't miss the strike, the steel talon's magic will fight the enchantments of the Minotaur's armor, which is a very thick piece of plate. If the steel talon wins, it will probably penetrate the armor out of sheer momentum. Then the barbed tip will do its job, and the Minotaur will bleed out in seconds, prey to his own blood pressure and lack of oxygen. That's their weakness, you see.
She winced for an instant and drew a horizontal line with her hand.
Our weakness, on the other hand. Right after spearing our target, there's this window of time when we must fly low, parallel to the ground, where we're open to counterattack with only our side weapons to defend ourselves. It only lasts about 5 seconds before we can regain altitude, but it feels like hours. I lost most of my friends that way. Torn to pieces by axes or dragged down by weighted nets. The lucky ones had time to cut their own throats before the Minotaurs captured them.
Perhaps Kes had more of Alder in her than she realized, because without intending to, she'd sewn an image in Ed's mind, like a wide painting of an unnamed battle. He saw a scorched mountain pass overlooking a glistening green sea, with rows upon rows of armored giants like humanoid tanks holding axes as big as a man's torso. He watched figures breaking through a field of clouds like falling stars, these elven Amazons wearing copper and flowing tunics, holding talons several times their size. He heard their war cries as they dove through the incoming Minotaur arrows, the projectiles tearing holes through the span of their white wings, culling their numbers. He saw the fury in their faces painted gold by the sunset and crimson by the blood of their fellow warriors. He felt in his bones the reverberation of the impact as they reached the lowest point of their dive together, then blood and dust bursting up into the air. Bodies collapsed with Minotaur and Avian rolling brutally on the ground, dead on impact, crumpled wings stained with mud and guts, and the survivors frantically pulling up as the axes and arrows pursued them and, sometimes, struck the avians out of the sky and pulled them back to earth while their hands futilely reached for the sun as it rose farther and farther from their reach. One avian that made it out had Kes's features. She was looking over her shoulder as she flew up and up among the survivors, her face contorted in pain as she saw what she was leaving behind, broken and bloodied on the ground below.
They told us how dangerous the dive was, and also how crucial to victory it was. Because without the dive, our armies had no way of reaching the Minotaur commands to assassinate it. With enough training, we could make it out alive, they told us. It was a lie. Training had nothing to do with who lived or who died. It was luck. Either you got targeted, or you didn't.
She steadied herself.
I thought I could protect them. I was wrong. The war lasted a long time. And somehow I lived long enough to stumble my way into a promotion. But deep down I knew that I had failed. But I kept trying. I don't know why. Maybe I am just too stubborn. Or maybe I just love violence deep down. When my squad got killed, I thought it was over. One last defeat. Apparently some god is entertained by my failures, though. Because I survived, although my wings were broken beyond repair and had to be amputated. They exiled me like a carrion avian and I came to Steravos, swearing I'd never fight again. But it turns out I don't know anything else but fighting. After a month in Undercity without a single coin in my pocket, It was either taking up the sword again, or the whorehouse.
Ed winced. Kes went on.
I came to Barova and stayed. The Rangers and the Sheriff needed an extra pair of hands, and I had the experience. At least a village only a few hours away from a port city should be easy enough to protect, right? We know how that went. And then I met you. A dungeon lord, bringing death and calamity to my village. You were about to kidnap Alvedra, remember? At least that's how it looked. Then I saw my chance to do something truly good. If I exchanged myself for her, I'd redeem myself. The girl would live, and I would die because I'd have refused to work with you. And then I'd have finally won.
She raised her hands and then let them fall limply to her sides.
And then I got to know you and the others better, and everything became so confusing.
That's good, isn't it? Surely things aren't so bad now, Ed said. At once, he wished he had a few more ranks in charm so he could have thought of something more helpful to say.
Ed, I love the haunt. In a way, it reminds me of home, while at the same time being entirely different. I love the way our people strut around trying to act dark because that's what they're supposed to do, but they only have Alder's tales as examples, so they're terrible at it. I love the way our backblends and horned spiders puff their chests with martial dignity because you expect them to act that way. You think they're more than forest critters, and so they are. I love waking up in the morning and realizing our community is bigger than it was the night before. That's dangerous, Ed. Loving something means you either get to see it die, or it gets to see you die. And the gods know the haunt has its fair share of danger. Seeing the way the Inquisitors think of us, how cheap our life is to them. I don't know. It's the same way I would have acted in their place. So I can't help but wonder if seeing all this...
She drew a wide arc with her arms.
Be destroyed is exactly what I deserve. Perhaps that's why the gods are preserving me. And why I keep surviving things that should have killed me long ago.
It was strange, hearing herself open up to him in this way. Kes had been, by far, the most closed up of Ed's friends. A tough warrior who kept her feelings in check. For her to speak to him so freely. It was a level of trust that Ed hoped he could someday be worthy of. At the very least, today, he could take her fears and concerns seriously. He wasn't sure what help he could be to her. Their lives were just so... different. But she had trusted him, and she deserved for him to at least try his best. So, he focused.
Did you... Are you using improved reflexes?
Kes asked after a while, raising an incredulous eyebrow and staring at the tension in Ed's face. Ed ended the talent.
I... needed time to think about what you said. It's a lot to take in.
He massaged his neck.
Look, I can't lie to you and tell you things will be all right, because shit may hit the fan at any time and we both know it. But I also think you're underestimating your own victories. I think they vastly overshadow the defeats.
Ed,
Kes said kindly.
I'm not sure that not dying so far counts as a victory.
But that's exactly it, Ed pointed out. It is a victory when your enemy is death itself. Every day... No, every second you are alive is a victory. Death only gets to defeat us once, and then it pretends all those millions of times we won don't count. Well, they count to me. And I know that deep down they also count to you. Death is a sore loser, Kes. But we don't have to be. Justice is not something that we define by the way we die. A good friend once told me I didn't get to decide if I was a good or bad person. It's those who we help or hurt who set the score. So go ask the people of Barova, the people of the Haunt, if they think you've protected them. If you've upheld justice. If you've done your best. And, forgive me if I overstep... But I would bet my life that your old squad thinks you have, because you think the world of them, and I'm sure they felt the same way about you. And I'm sure we, Alder, Kleck, Levy, and the others, cannot ever replace what you've lost, but we can be right there with you when it's time to fight again, because I don't think you're the kind of person that ever surrenders, and there's a lot of wrongs to be righted. Perhaps it was luck that has kept you alive so far, but you get to decide why, and I think you know that.
There was a heavy pause while the two mulled over their words. Ed flicked a pearl of sweat away from his forehead. He could feel the cool dungeon air calming his heartbeat.
It's a shame you never met my old squad. I think you would have liked them. We were all horrible at speaking of what was going on inside, but they were like you. So full of defiance, they honestly made you think we could go against the gods themselves and win.
She tapped the side of her nose, then gave him a genuine smile. The kind that erased 10 years of hardship from her face and let the idealistic avian girl she'd been a long time ago shine through in all her radiant beauty. If only for an instant, before the grizzled survivor returned.
Now I'm all nostalgic. You know what? Sometimes people with high charm may say beautiful things that make you feel all fuzzy inside, but once they leave, all that stuff vanishes. Words are rare, except worse, because you cannot soar on them. But when warriors speak their truth, when we raise our fists in rage against the heavens, that's real. That's our soul.
She stood up, groaning as she did.
Thanks for hearing me out, Ed. I don't remember the last time I talked about my life, if at all. I didn't expect it. But I guess you were right. Speaking about it helped.
Ed smiled, unsure if he'd actually done anything right. Kes had done it herself. All he'd done was trust she would.
Sure. Anytime.
By now, the drones had long finished fitting the armor. He stepped up, and the two of them headed for the door.
A word of warning, though,
Kes said, only half-jokingly.
I may be a bit testy for a while. I'm still fucking angry, after all. Feel free to call me out if I take it out on you guys.
We'll handle it, Ed said. What else are friends for?
Kes grinned.
For one, they're very useful at drawing aggro,
she said. The list of Ed's available talents had grown since the last time he looked, thanks to Kes's training and his own increasing expertise as a dungeon lord. The options now dwarfed the rather rigid character builds he'd worked with in Ivalice Online. He had a drone bring him a coal stick and used an empty section of wall to do some quick calculations.
What about power attack?
Kes suggested.
That's a fighter's cornerstone talent, and I'd sleep a lot easier knowing you had it in your arsenal. He needs more arcane power to throw around,
Levy said.
Since we still haven't found spellbooks so we can learn new formulas, he should get all the magical talents he can use as a dungeon lord.
How about more defenses like his pledge of armor?
Asked Kleck.
Perhaps with the right defenses in place, we need not worry about those nasty, shiny attacks.
Alder shook his head.
If Ed stacks too many always-on talents like the pledge, the strain on his body could kill him. Many famous heroes met their untimely demise that way, you know. Power Strike could work because it's an activated effect, the same as his evil eye. My own build is going to focus on activated talents, for example, so I can get a wide variety without worrying about my heart exploding at 35.
All those are good suggestions, Ed said. I agree with the three of you, actually. Here, look at my favorite options.
He focused and made a conscious effort to share his talent sheet with his friends. Power Strike, 30 experience. The user adds +1 to his brawn attribute when making an attack with a melee weapon. Energy Drain, activated, moderate. Dungeon Vision, 20 experience. The Dungeon Lord can watch any location in an owned dungeon he's currently inside as if he were present there. The location must be uncontested. Energy Drain, none. Hypnotic Evil Eye, 40 experience. The Dungeon Lord's Evil Eye is upgraded with an activated gaze attack. Hypnotic Evil Eye forces the target into locking stares with the Dungeon Lord for a minute unless they resist a mind contest.
On a failure, the target can't avert their gaze and is vulnerable to mind spells and illusions cast by the Dungeon Lord. Energy drain? Active. Low. Choosing this upgrade disables the Veil-Piercing Evil Eye upgrade tree. Veil-Piercing Evil Eye. 30 experience. The Dungeon Lord's Evil Eye is upgraded with a constant effect. The Evil Eye can now detect invisibility and similar forms of concealment and has an advantage at piercing illusions and magical misdirection. Veil piercing cannot affect legendary ranked magic or higher. Energy drain? Constant. Very low. Choosing this upgrade disables the Hypnotic Evil Eye upgrade tree. Pledge of Burning Armor. 60 experience. The Dungeon Lord's Pledge of Armor is upgraded with new effects. As an activated effect, he can surround his armor in magical fire similar to the effects of the spell Eldritch Edge. This wall of fire won't damage the Dungeon Lord or his minions. In addition, the Dungeon Lord can now resist the effects of non-magical heat, as if he possessed the Resist Elements talent. Energy drain? Moderate while activated, very low otherwise. Pledge of Muted Armor. 40 experience. The Dungeon Lord's Pledge of Armor is upgraded with new effects. Upon falling unconscious or being otherwise impaired, a team of 4 rescue drones is generated around his person. The rescue drones will stop at nothing to drag the Dungeon Lord to the nearest safe place, but they lack defensive capabilities. In addition, the Dungeon Lord can hide his armor's magical output at no extra energy cost. Energy drain? Constant. Very low. Choosing this upgrade disables the Pledge of Burning Armor upgrade tree. Elder Lord Aura. 80 experience. The Dungeon Lord's Ancient Lord Aura is upgraded with new effects. He and the minions in the area of effect are now resistant to holy magical sources. His minions are immune to mind control magic, and all the attribute bonuses they receive from Ancient Lord Aura are increased by 1 extra rank. Energy drain? Activated. High. Wraith Step. 50 experience. The Dungeon Lord gains the ability to instantly transport himself to any uncontested location of a dungeon he owns and is currently inside. All the items he wears on his person are transported as well. Energy drain? Activated. Moderate. Banshee Shriek. 50 experience. The Dungeon Lord gains a scream attack. Any creature within hearing range must immediately pass an endurance contest. If they fail, they become frightened and unable to cast spells. Any creature with a fortitude rank lower than 5 is instantly killed instead. Energy drain? Activated. High. Advanced spellcasting. 60 experience. Improves the spellcasting talent, allowing the user to cast advanced ranked spells. The user starts with 1 advanced spell per day besides his basic ones. Upgrading to this talent slows down improvement of the basic version. Levy whistled when she was done reading. Since objectivity governed everyone in Ivalice, talking about experience and talent choices was a globally shared hobby.
Remember when our hardest choice was between resist disease or resist poison?
This is only the curated version, Ed said with a hint of pride. I left out all the endure elements to save time.
That's what a rigorous training regimen will do for you,
Kes said.
Now that you're reaping the benefits, I'll drive you even harder, Dungeon Lord.
I can see those talents aren't cheap, Alder mused. Our talent choices are already improving, so the point cost will keep increasing from now on. How many points does the average Dungeon Lord earn? Even the most adventurous bard taps out before 1,000 or so.
Lord Kale had about 2,000 when he died,
Levy said.
He was strong, but he wasn't the most powerful Dungeon Lord ever to walk the Earth, so maybe 3,000 as the upper limit?
Kes nodded.
Adventurers and mercenaries cap out near 2,000, I'd say. If they live long enough to reach that level, they're aging and slowing down and they've kingdoms and armies that do the fighting for them. So, even if they wanted to, they would have no reason to leave their castles. Their combat skills and physical attributes slowly fade. But that's just how life goes. It happens to everyone. Unless you're a lich, I guess.
Ed scratched his chin. Heroes don't have that problem. When I played Io, we racked up tens of thousands of points in only a few days. In hindsight, The ease with which his character had thrown around spells bewildered him. He had about 6 daily spells as a dungeon lord, and that was after months of grinding. That means I need to make every talent count if I'm to go against them.
Not alone,
Kleck reminded him.
Of course, Ed said.
He gave the Batblin a thumbs up.
I'm counting on you, man. You have any suggestions for me?
Kleck told him to get the talents that would make him seem bigger and meaner, so everyone would leave the haunt alone.
Ed didn't have a rebuttal for that.
The logic was flawless. He had 130 experience points to allocate. It would be a considerable increase in power, so he wasn't making the choices lightly. But it also meant he couldn't buy all the talents he wanted. Not all at once, at least.
The aura upgrade seems powerful, Kes said. Resistance to magic is something most warriors would give an arm for. It's expensive, though. It'll leave you space for Power Strike and perhaps the dungeon vision.
She scratched her chin.
Not that I'm looking forward to not having any privacy.
Levy cursed under her breath.
Just great. I hadn't thought of that.
Ed raised an eyebrow.
If I get the talent, I'd obviously respect people's privacy. It'd just let me react faster in case an alarm triggers.
Sure,
Levy said, narrowing her eyes.
Like an alarm that triggers when the ladies' baths are in use. Don't you think I'm not onto your plan, Dungeon Lord?
Ed decided to ignore the comment.
What about you, Alder?
Well, I would combo the vision with that Wraith Step talent to instantly arrive at the baths when that alarm triggers.
I mean, what talents would you get?
Ah, in that case, I'd want to get both the Evil Eye upgrades. I've heard of a couple Dungeon Lords that devoted themselves to maxing out theirs, and they could do pretty impressive things. For instance, Lord Colfair, new Merios' archenemy, could turn his enemies into stone and animate the stones to fight for him. He had this amazing garden decorated with his defeated foes where he and Numerios had their final battle.
Alder sighed nostalgically.
I wrote a dissertation on that tale back in Elytra. Anyway, if I had to choose, Hypnotic Evil Eye would combo nicely with my illusions, but you don't use those. The Burning Armor one, then, if only because I'd look incredible playing my music while on fire.
I can't believe you'd invest in a 60-point talent just because of vanity,
Levy said.
I'm glad that Ed is more mature than that.
Actually, he's right. Strolling around while casually on fire would be great.
Ed was sure he had once fought a final boss with that talent while playing Ivalice Online. If he was right, then the burning armor upgrade path involved some sort of damage reflection and increased elemental resistances. It had made for an interesting fight. But was it the best path for Ed's build? Some gamers, like his friend Mark, ignored armor's stats and went for the coolest-looking item. There was a lure in that approach, but it was anathema to Ed's power-gaming ways.
If I could set myself on fire and not burn,
Kleck mused, almost to himself,
I could sleep anywhere in the forest, and no wolf would try to eat me.
Ed coughed politely and decided to change the subject.
And you, Levy?
You know magic is simply superior. Advanced spellcasting, obviously. In fact, I'm picking it up soon myself. I want to improve my specters. As they are, they're little more than fodder for the Inquisitors. And to make them a threat, I need access to advanced hex rituals. I'd also get that Banshee Shriek talent, because getting swarmed by assholes with heavy sticks is a witch's nightmare. I'd combo it with an endurance training spell, which fits my build, and hopefully they'd all die in a single cast.
She smiled dreamily.
With any luck, their bodies would all strike the floor at the same time.
Alder took a step away from the witch. Ed considered his options. The biggest issue was that he didn't have enough experience to buy all the talents he wanted outright. So he'd have to prioritize. Which ones did he need right now?
I'll have to take Pledge of Muted Armor, he said. The drone effect would have been very useful after Galio's attack, and hiding the magical output lets me blend in better in Undercity.
It was a shame to lose out on the cool burning effect, but following the muted path adhered better to his character build. He wasn't supposed to draw aggro to himself, since all an enemy needed to do to destroy the haunt was to kill him. Covering himself in magical fire would just paint a huge target on his back, begging for a volley of fireball runes.
I wish I could take the aura, but it's simply too expensive, and with such a high energy drain, I doubt I could keep it running for long enough. I'll leave that upgrade for later and go for advanced spellcasting instead, along with veil-piercing evil eye.
Just so you know, going the advanced route will slow down your basic spell grinding,
Levy pointed out.
That's why I'm waiting a bit before buying it.
I plan to wait a bit as well, Ed said, but not too much. Advanced will let me pick 2 spells without a spellbook, right? Those could really come in handy.
So, no power strike,
said Kes.
Well, it's your funeral. Don't complain when someone sticks you inside an anti-magic field and you have nothing to hit 'em with.
Luckily for me, I've a marshal who can hold her ground in that case, Ed told her with a grin. Don't worry, I'll take power strike eventually, along with Wraith Step and Dungeon Vision. They all fit my build, and since they are activated, they won't strain my body.
He planned to get the aura upgrade, but first he'd need to raise both his endurance and his leadership skill, which had the side effect of reducing the aura's energy cost. With that said, he bought the veil piercing and the pledge of muted armor upgrades, leaving him with just enough experience points to buy advanced spellcasting once he was done grinding basic spells. He nodded with satisfaction as his character sheet updated itself to reflect the upgrades. He had a vague physical awareness that he was now stronger than he'd been an instant ago. The sensation was like waking from a good night's sleep and finding his favorite breakfast already waiting for him. He decided to try the improved evil eye right now. He turned it on, feeling the familiar heat spread across his face as the eldritch green flames drew shadows across the walls. Any difference?
I think,
Levy said, squinting at him.
If you look carefully, there is a sort of blue sparkling at the end of the flames. Nothing too dramatic, so I would have missed it if I hadn't looked for it.
Sparks, then.
Ed turned off his evil eye, feeling a bit dejected. Magical talents could sometimes have very dramatic effects, and others you wouldn't know were there without reading the character sheet.
Guess not all dungeon lords can go into combat covered in magical flames.
Perhaps if he really wanted to, Alder and he could figure a way to imitate the effect using illusions.
But that would be vanity, he thought sadly.
Well, do you see anything different?
Kes asked.
Any hidden enchantments, maybe?
Kleck turned around as if expecting an unseen attack. His ears gyrated like radar dishes, ready to follow any suspicious sound. Ed took a careful look around.
No, I don't think so. Everything looks normal to me, but that doesn't mean we're safe. The upgrade doesn't detect legendary magic or higher.
If there is a legendary illusion or mind control effect in place, we're screwed anyway, whether or not we could see it.
That's reassuring, said Alder.
He didn't look very reassured.
I've a bit of experience saved up, too, so I'll run it your way later, guys. I'm wondering just how far I can push my own illusion magic. I want to make it a part of my performances, you know? Like some kind of special effect. Like the ones in that vision I had.
To Ed's surprise, the chapel was in use when he and his friends entered. 2 dozen villagers, dressed in their best suits, either sat respectfully in the rough wooden benches or chatted among themselves near the back. More than a few of them wore shoddy necklaces with bits of silver, and sometimes an entire head of garlic. Ed raised an eyebrow. He had built the chapel as a means to get holy water and blessed weapons. As far as he was aware, the villagers from Barova prayed to neutral local deities, like Hogbus, and spirits in charge of fertility and harvest and death. Oinus, a light-aligned god of commerce, shouldn't have gotten any attention from them. Yet here they were. Unable to ignore his curiosity, he stopped near the entrance. The magical torches were set to a low glow, and incense burned in a brass lamp set over the altar at the end. A female Batblin wearing a white dress stood next to the altar and played a few notes on a lute. Some villagers had their eyes closed and their hands crossed as if in prayer, while others knelt over small baskets set in lines before the altar. The baskets' insides glinted in the low light. Ed squinted and realized they were filled with coins. Aureus cents of bronze and steel, Vifara cents with a tiny gemstone fragment engraved, but mostly the dull, multicolored rings of small denomination balts, the local currency before Halagese conquered Steravos. Ed and Levy exchanged an alarmed glance. "Did we start this?" he mouthed at her. The chapel was dedicated to Oinus, the god of commerce. The villagers had lost their places of worship in Barova's destruction, so now they had taken to this one instead. Levy bit her lip and raised her shoulders. "Maybe," she mouthed back. It was another cultural difference that marked Ed as a stranger from another world. Back on Earth, religion was a complex matter that involved tradition, culture, laws, family, and individual consideration. Ivalis was similar, except that the gods answered the prayers and were aggressively interested in getting people's worship. Even better if they stole their enemies' worshippers. On one hand, the average Ivalian farmer family could influence the local weather during harvest by performing the adequate sacrifices. On the other hand, however, they could just as well get kidnapped and sacrificed by crazed cultists who wanted to convince their multi-tentacled deity not to eat them for that night's dessert. Ed wasn't sure which world had the best system. A group of four by the back caught sight of him and his companions, and their chat halted. Ed recognized a few of them as they approached. Brian was there, his eye patch making him instantly recognizable. He had showered today, which was an improvement. Darla was next to him. She was the local gossip, a woman with both the attitude and odor of curdled milk. The other two were recent additions to the haunt, a candlemaker and a hatter that had left their towns to join their families in the haunt. They'd both taken minionship recently.
"Dungeon Lord, what a pleasure to see you out and triumphant!"
Darla half sang. She had a garlic medallion dangling from her neck. Next to Ed, Kes stared daggers at the woman.
"It was said on the grapevine that you had fallen during the raid, that a terrible spell had cursed you to an unending sleep, and that the curse could only be broken by true love's kiss. Hell, there was a line of brave damsels about to form, eager to save our handsome, unmarried dungeon lord. I'm happily married myself, of course, but I would have gladly sent my daughters to do their duty for the haunt."
Ed's eye twitched.
"Well, I'm glad to put those rumors at rest."
He didn't mind the teasing, as he knew. Hoped, actually, that most of it wasn't serious, but he wasn't yet used to rebuking it gracefully from his position as their dungeon lord.
Don't mind her," Brian said. "She started those rumors herself, I reckon."
He grasped his bonnet in both hands, nervously.
"We didn't mean to bother you or your companions, Lord Edward. We just wanted to say we're glad the quest came out right, is all. Everyone saw the quest screen update itself with our victory against those accursed inquisitors, but we had no news beyond that. I figured we could get the Kuftars drunk later tonight and make them spill the beans. But until then, we came here to thank Oinus for his part in the haunt's success."
"Sharing the news is my job," Alder said,
full of hurt feelings.
"I was getting to it. Making sure the tale is properly glorious takes time, you know."
Ed massaged his chin.
"Thanks for worrying, Brian," he said.
The man perked up at the mention of his name, which surprised Ed. Did that small gesture really mean that much?
"I'm sure that between Alder and the Kuftar's version of the tale, you'll hear all about it soon enough. In the meantime, do you mind answering a small question? What exactly are you praying for when you come here?"
"Oh, I thought you already knew, given that you gave us the chapel in the first place. We kinda figured you meant for us to use it, and, to be honest, it was a good call.
The villagers seemed eager to help. It was strange how things changed. Not long ago, Brine had tried to lead a small rebellion to escape the haunt.
Oinus is an easy fellow to understand, my lord. He likes the good stuff. Gold, I reckon. But any cold, hard coin will do in a pinch. The bigger the favor, the more he wants. So we barter with him. For a few cents, he helped Long Lurk here.
He pointed at the hatter next to him, a man who looked the part of his nickname.
Find his favorite hammer. It appeared inside one of those baskets, just like that. I gave him 3 bolts, and in exchange he made one of my cows recover from the runs. Things like that. Oinus enjoys when we make money, so we can give him a part. Kind of like Brett's taxes in Barova. Only Oinus is actually useful.
I see, Ed said.
From that perspective, the practice seemed harmless enough. Although he wondered what would happen if the villagers began bribing Oinus to mess with their business rivals. And then those answered in kind. A divine-enhanced price war couldn't end well at all. And there were also the Sterevosi deities to worry about.
"Won't your previous deities get mad that you're now praying to a light god?" he asked Brine.
"I reckon they will,"
said Brine, smiling from ear to ear.
"Serves him right. The lazy rascals didn't help much while our livelihood burned to ash, so a bit of pressure is exactly what they need to step their act up. I'll bet you a red bolt that during this year's Spraveska they'll be all cozy and charming. Perhaps even Hogbus's avatar will stop by for appearance's sake."
Thanks to his mantle's sixth sense, Ed knew that standing there with his mouth wide open would be an unseemly thing for a dungeon lord. So he caught himself in time.
Barely. A god's avatar showing up for a small community's Spraveska?
Brine had to be exaggerating. He was about to ask, but Darla spoke first.
"Speaking of the Spraveska,"
she said eagerly,
"there'll be one this year, right? I don't mean to offend. The grapevine is all. They wonder. Seeing that you come from another world, they wonder if you really care for our festivals and traditions. Obviously, I told them all to pound dung with that attitude."
Ed noted how she didn't mention at any point who they were.
"But still, people are wondering. They would listen to me better if I could tell them my reassurances came straight from your mouth, my lord."
Ed didn't need his mantle to know the only possible response to that kind of setup.
"Of course there'll be a Spraveska this year," he said, with a tone of incredulity that earned him a pride-filled glance from Alder. "I'd never even dream of not having one. I'm appalled that I even have to say it aloud," his quasi-offended tone said.
He hadn't the faintest idea what a Spraveska was. The villagers exchanged bright smiles.
"I'll let everyone know,"
chirped Darla.
"The entire haunt shall know I was right."
Ed nodded, and inwardly wondered just how much trouble had his mouth gotten him into. He made a mental note to ask Kes later what the hell he was supposed to do. The marshal's face was inscrutable. Although he could swear she had been repressing laughter just before he looked.
"It's probably my imagination," he hoped. "Time to change topics." "Brine," he said aloud, putting on a serious expression. "Let me get this straight. You guys are playing an incredibly dangerous game of setting deity against deity just to force them to give you better stuff when the Spraveska arrives?" Brine saw his face and his smile dropped. But then Ed clasped the man's shoulder.
"Good man. That's a very proper attitude for a haunt citizen. No, really, I mean it. When the world and the gods want to play games with us, the haunt plays back, and we play for keeps. Remember that."
Ed winked at the villagers and took his leave. As he walked off, he heard Brine mutter to himself,
"A haunt citizen?"
with his voice full of amazement. Kes matched his pace.
"Ed,"
she whispered at him,
"are you trying to transform the haunt's entire population into danger-loving rule abusers like you? because that's what you'll get if you keep praising their silly little games like that.
Ed's smile grew an inch.
See, he told his friend. I was thinking that my mouth probably already got me into a bit of trouble with that Spraveska comment, and you know what people say. In for a penny.
He tossed a quarter aureus into one of the baskets. Chapter 13. Friendly Negotiations. There was a small door to the right of the altar that led to a passageway that split in three. One path went to Zachary's private quarters, another to the cemetery, and the last one to a grim, humid chamber with a low vaulted ceiling and naked slabs of granite as floor that served as a chamber to prepare the corpses for burial. Today, the black tables strewn across the chamber were thankfully empty, except for the one with the old coffin, set straight into the middle of the room. Zachary and Governor Brett watched it under the protection of three of Kaga's Kuftar, armed to the teeth with rows of silver-tipped stakes and vials of holy water.
"Ah, Lord Edward," said Zachary as Ed and the others approached. "Glad to see the grapevine was wrong about your injury. I knew that a devoted follower of the light like you, even though unjustly exiled from the flock, couldn't possibly have fallen prey to a holy attack."
He puffed his chest up and gave Brett a slanted, I-told-you-so look. The governor and one of the Kuftar rolled their eyes when Zachary wasn't looking. The fact that an unjustly exiled member of the Light's flock had been the one directly striking at the Inquisition this time around never seemed to cross Zachary's mind. It was interesting, the lengths that people could go to maintain their personal worldview, so long as it was convenient for them to have it. Ed wondered if there was a way for him to know when he did the same thing. But wasn't that, by definition, impossible?
"Well, thanks for the vote of confidence, Zachary," he said aloud. "I'm eager to see what you did to protect us from our guest. Levy here told me that you and Governor Brett outdid yourselves."
Now it was Brett's turn to puff out his chest.
"Master Levina would be right, if I may say so myself."
He made an ample gesture toward the coffin with his arm, like a chef presenting a perfect dish.
"Right this way, Lord Edward, Master Kesser, Master Alder, Master Levina."
He guided them in a way that resembled a proud museum guide, with Zachary tagging along, looking vaguely resentful at Brett hogging the spotlight.
"The crux of the quest that Lord Edward wisely entrusted to us was dual in nature. How to protect ourselves from our guest and keep him from escaping, while at the same time protecting it from true destruction. Our solution was, I hope, both clever and simple."
Brett pointed at the floor around the table, which had a magical circle drawn with a mixture of silver dust, salt, and a tar-like substance to make it stick to the slabs of rock. He then pointed at the ceiling where a similar circle was drawn exactly above the first. Ed nodded in approval. The two circles were similar to the ones in his room. The haunt was getting good at making them.
"This is to keep the creature out," said Brett. "A simple measure. Even a child could have thought of it."
Zachary raised an offended eyebrow at that.
"What makes it truly clever is the fact that almost every section of this chamber has been heavily sanctified, except the area inside the circle. The Kuftar wanted us to warn you about it, but obviously their fear was misplaced, since you're clearly unhurt and the rumors were wrong anyway."
Ah, shit.
Ed almost expected to burst into holy flames right then and there, like a cartoon coyote that stepped into thin air but only fell when he remembered how gravity worked. He opened his mouth to speak, but someone had already beat him to it.
"Brett,"
Kes said with a dangerously sweet voice.
"You forgot to mention this when you showed us the room."
Her smile was full of teeth.
"It's true that Lord Edward wasn't hurt, but keeping the information to yourself was not your call to make. In the future, please inform me, the head of security, remember, of all potentially dangerous adjustments you make, especially if there's magic involved."
Brett paled at the rebuke.
"I mean, I didn't. We didn't."
"Actually, it's the head researcher who should be informed of any dangerous magic,"
Levy pointed out, calmly picking a fingernail.
Both of us, then,
Kes said.
Make it three,
Alder said.
I'd like to be close enough to see the fireworks go off once someone messes up.
Kleck will probably want to know as well,
Levy said, while Brett stammered apologies.
If only because the crazy little guy would try to slap the holy flames off Ed if it came to it.
Ed took a deep breath. He suspected that he knew the reason why so many dungeon lords had unavoidably gone raving mad after a few decades.
Look, he said, it was a mistake. It happens. No harm was done. Just simply be more careful next time.
Besides, the blessings had come from Oinus, and the greedy deity was friendly to anyone willing to barter with him. Hell, respecting one's own business arrangements was one of Oinus's core tenets for his faithful. Surely Ed was safe from him. Or as safe as he could expect to be, at least.
Your brutalness is most kind,
Brett said, bowing. Ed pointed at the coffin.
What other measures are in place?
We made sure the people are well protected in case of an escape. Unlikely as it is. All our guards were equipped with Monster Hunter silver-tipped stakes, and the captain's got a vial of holy water. In addition, we fashioned necklaces with a bit of silver in them, and everyone that enters the chapel must wear one. It's a small layer of protection that will hinder the vampire's feeding. Just a way to buy time for our forces to capture him while he's weak.
Brett raised both eyebrows as if surprised by his own cleverness.
The villagers took over the idea and made their own necklaces, though, using garlic and other small charms that may or may not slow the creature down. It's hard to distinguish between real magic and local superstition, even for me after all the years I've spent among them.
Levy shook her head.
It won't slow him down that much, I think, but it's better than nothing.
Before Brett could go on, Zachary stepped in and cut him off with a wave.
Ah, I'm best equipped to explain the next problem we solved. You see, Lord Edward, my blessings and the circle will force the vampire to remain around his coffin, as well as nullify most of his powers. But there was still one we had to deal with. Some vampires can enthrall with a gaze, not unlike a more powerful version of the Minor Order spell, and in most bardic tales about them, they're able to use said power to force a captor to break the circle or their bindings.
I'm not sure if old bloods are actually the ones with that power,
Levy said.
It gets confusing, and sometimes the research tomes seem to forget which type the protagonist is and mix their powers and weaknesses around. But Brett's right. If they have it, they like to use their hypnosis to enthrall the attractive young priestess guarding the circle. But, as it turns out, vampiric mind magic doesn't affect their destined soulmates.
Levy trailed off, her cheeks turning pink.
I mean, those with a very strong spirit.
Alder narrowed his eyes.
I'd love to have a look at those research tomes of yours, Levy.
Alas, they were all lost forever in one of Kale's dungeons,
the witch quickly blurted out.
Right.
Zachary took a white handkerchief from his tunic and cleaned a bit of sweat from his scalp.
To combat their gaze, we fashioned this.
He rummaged through his pockets and brought out a circular piece of glass tied to a rough wooden handle. The glass's surface seemed covered in dust, and Ed realized it was silver.
Anyone interrogating the creature is to hold this lens at face level. The glass is blessed and doused in holy water for good measure. It should, in theory, protect the wearer from the hypnotic gaze.
Kes stepped forward, staring at the lens with a critical eye.
Okay, I admit I'm not the best versed in magical matters, but how exactly is a bit of glass supposed to stop someone from being hypnotized?
Everyone turned to stare at Levy.
Oh.
She tossed her hair back, looking for a second like a fawn staring in wonder at the quickly growing shadow of a griffin on the surrounding grass.
Well, I approved it because it makes sense, in theory. Almost all kinds of offensive magic need to establish a connection between the caster and his target, after all. In other words, to pierce someone with an ice bolt, you need to aim and actually hit them with the damn thing. You can't simply have the wounds appear on their body. Enough spellcasters tried to get away with that in the good old days and were instantly gobbled up by objectivity.
She raised her eyebrow a fraction of an inch at Ed in a gesture that he could only interpret as, "So don't even think of it."
"Gaze attacks? And perhaps even Ed's evil eye, if you really want me to get theoretical. Must have a way of creating that connection, even if we cannot see it. Like, some sort of invisible ray."
"That sounds quite plausible, actually," Ed said. For someone who was mostly self-taught, Levy was capable of some impressive academic feats. She had learned her Ray's Spectre spell on her own, for example, just by stubbornly throwing herself at the problem until it gave in and spilled its secrets. It was interesting, though, seeing her doubt herself when speaking about something she was quite talented at, when she was so confident at pretty much everything else.
"She probably knows enough to realize how much information she's missing," Ed thought.
"That's how Numerios defeated Lord Calfair," Alder said. "He held a magical mirror against Calfair's gaze. The Dungeon Lord was immune to his own magic, but his minions weren't."
Ed nodded. Alder's example was anecdotal, but the Dungeon Lord was sure they could test Levy's hypothesis by playing with mirrors in her laboratory.
"You know what? I think we've just gotten a small magical research quest here," he said aloud.
"Oh, I love those,"
Levy said, clapping with delight. With an effort of will and a flash of evil eye, Ed gave Levy her own personal quest. Levy's eyes glinted with greed at the rewards. She was in the process of showing Alder the screen when Kes stepped hard on the floor to get everyone's attention.
"Sorry to interrupt your very interesting discussion about ways to goad the objectivity into destroying you," she said. "But the sun is setting, and you're having this chat right in front of a vampire's coffin."
Alder winced.
"Right. We got a bit carried away," the bard said.
Ed turned to Zachary and Brett, who waited next to the silent Kufdar guards at a safe distance from the coffin.
"Thank you for your help. You both did very well."
Zachary bowed, and then raised a surprised eyebrow as he read something in his character sheet.
"Will you look at that?" he said. "We were part of a side quest for the Haunt's raid."
20 experience points, Brett boasted. "Not bad for a day's work."
When the two left the chamber, they looked very pleased with themselves. Once Zachary and Brett had closed the door behind them, Kes strolled to the monster hunters, her back straight and tense like a steel bar.
"Have everyone leave the chapel," she told them, "and have a drone bar it from the outside. Return here when you're done, but first make the announcement. The Haunt is now on violet alert. All alarm spells and traps are now activated. All our citizens must remain in the company of at least another citizen and within screaming distance of a guard patrol. Until I give the all clear, anyone who forgets the password when asked for it by a guard captain is to be detained for their own safety and put under watch until Master Levina or Lord Edward can confirm their identity. Anyone not a guard captain asking for the password is to be detained and watched. A guard captain not asking for the password using the specific wording we rehearsed is to be detained and watched."
Her instructions kept droning on and on until even Ed lost track of Kes's paranoid security measures. The Kufdar listened with perfect discipline.
"Yes, Marshal,"
they said once she was done. They saluted her by crossing an arm to their chest, then turned and saluted Ed the same way before leaving the room.
"Satisfied?" Ed asked.
"Not by a long shot, but I cannot burden the Haunt with anything further until they are better trained," the Marshal said. "Better that they pay attention to the basics than mangle proper security measures."
"Basic?" Alder asked. "You call that basic? You didn't even tell us the passwords. If Ed steps out of this chamber, I think he would be detained and watched."
"Well, of course I would be," Ed said. "Violet alert means there is risk of subversion, sabotage, impersonation, and or infiltration. It's designed to deal, as a worst-case scenario, with a shape-changer loose inside the dungeon. If I were to step out of this room before the all-clear signal is given, it could mean I'm being impersonated or enthralled."
"Ah, Alita's tits! You're encouraging her!"
Alder exclaimed. Then he glanced nervously at the floor.
"I mean, by Oinus's bountiful grace," he mumbled.
"Of course I encourage her,"
Ed said, trying to repress his grin. That's her job, Alder.
But if someone is controlling you, couldn't he have you give the all clear anyway?
Alder asked.
Indeed,
Kes said.
That's why no one who knows the all clear signal can handle the prisoner directly. We'll leave the room and let someone else who doesn't know the signal take over. Normally, a trained professional would do it.